Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen, and welcome to 2018. It has been an amazing summer of films and fun, and we are back, and we have our wonderful, wonderful panel with us. Joining us, esteemed traveler and film blogger, Virat Nehru. Virat, welcome back.
Yes, I am back from a third world country, back to my privileged first world lifestyle.
Where there are films at every corner, and we're every day. And Chris Evans, our intrepid filmmaker, who is back and been making films all summer. You've had a wonderful
some of the
time.
Some of the summer. Yeah, I've had a pretty good time lately. It's good to be back in the air.
It is. Wow. It's been, a lot's happened in the past month.
Talking about making films, though, congratulations to our newest filmmaker on the panel, Glenn Falkenstein, who is now a certified filmmaker.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He has a good eye. I was impressed.
Yeah, I was told that he has a good eye. I've yet to critically assess that, but waiting to look at his efforts.
Oh dear, my film's going to be reviewed on Film Fight Club now. I don't know if I can take that.
Ooh. We'll see. That could be a segment down the line.
That could be quite fun.
For anyone who wants to be a filmmaker, because I know a lot of people who listen to these shows, you know, might have that, you know, in the back of their mind desire, like, what if one day I just went out there and made a film? We would like to rep once more for Kino Cabaret and Kino Sydney. They're an organization where you can make any film you want, basically, and show it to people in a judgment-free space once a month. Glenn came along to the Kino Cabaret last December, shortly before we ended the show.
It was. And I had so much fun.
Yeah, 48 hours of filmmaking madness.
It was great. I made one of my own, and I helped out with a bunch of others. And if you do want to make films and you're a little nervous about it, this is a perfect way to get it on the ground.
Yeah, they'll be having their first event of the year. I believe it's either the 24th or the 25th of January. You'll have to look into this, but it's at Sun Studios in Alexandria.
And we'll be talking more about that soon. Now, you may be curious as to why we are on the air at 6 p.m. That is because for the next month, we will be on the air on Wednesday nights from 6 till 7, bringing you all the best awards, show contention, and films. And we are obviously also on the 2SDL website, so please do tune in at this time.
Say what? 1 hour of Film Fight Club?
Whoa!
Over the summer, yeah.
You have us for one whole hour of movies and fighting.
I can't even deal. So much movie, so much entertainment, so much fighting, so many dudes.
So many.
We'll try to keep having women on the show. We'll do our best to be benevolent in our sexism.
Hashtag times up.
Well, we do have many amazing guests. We'll be having many more amazing guests and filmmakers throughout the year, which we're looking forward to. But for the moment, we are talking about the biggest film event of this week, which is the Golden Globe Awards, which just happened. We are talking about the best of 17. It is 2018. We were talking about doing this in 2017, but we really wanted to hold off until 2017 to pass so we can see all the boxing day releases.
Yeah.
But first, we want to talk about the biggest film of 2017, undoubtedly, and that is The Last Jedi. Now, just forewarning, this, it has been out a month, and we've seen it a couple of times each, so this is a spoiler-filled discussion. We will be talking about some of the intricacies of the film, some of the major and most controversial aspects. So if you have not seen the film, we strongly recommend you do. But just tune in another 15 minutes or so.
15 minutes, yeah. So I guess the time starts now. Come back at 6:20.
Yeah, but like,
maybe every 5 minutes we should add a little warning to the listeners who are tuning in now.
Yeah. Who are we kidding, though?
I mean, spoiled Star Wars.
It's Star Wars, so who are we kidding? I'm pretty sure all of you have seen it. If you haven't seen it, you probably don't care, in which case, join the queue.
Well, we do recommend you see it because it is quite something, if only as a discussion piece. Now, it's actually quite interesting. The last show of last year, we finished on the evening of Wednesday, December 13th.
Yeah, when Star Wars was about to premiere, and me and Glenn saw it that night.
We did. We had a lot of fun. And we're picking right up where we left off, as does The Last Jedi.
Yes.
Now, we...
nice segue.
Thank you. Now, we've reviewed quite a few films this year, and quite a few of them are very controversial, or very divisive, I should say. Mother was one. Killing a Sacred Deer was one. Though The Last Jedi might just take the cake as the most divisive film of 2017.
Yeah, what is going on? It's a Disney blockbuster four-quadrant crowd pleaser, and yet people can't stop tearing each other's hair out over it.
There was a fan petition to get it removed from the canon at one point, and that was taken down.
That's pathetic.
Yeah. But actually, going back to Mother, I still found it to be the most exciting, divisive film. Because
dude, we'll get to talk about Mother later on.
It caused an actual division between Jennifer Lawrence and Darren Aronofsky.
We can save this for later. We should talk about Star Wars now. Trust me, I'll find a way to bring Mother into this. anyway.
So Mother is the new Terrence Malick of Film Fight Club. You heard it here first.
Anyway,
now The Last Jedi. It is remarkable because, I mean, I can't think of a film of this notoriety, of this level of blockbuster, where the division among critics and fans, for instance, Rotten Tomatoes has it on 90% of critics and users at 60%. It's quite something.
I think, you know, since we never did a proper review, before we get into just talking about how controversial it is, what did we all think of it?
Yeah, that's
good or bad?
Well, I would say I thought, on balance, it was a good film. Not necessarily a great Star Wars film, but a good film with major reservations. I'm going to run through what I liked and disliked about it briefly. We're each going to do that and then have a bit of a discussion. I'll say what I liked about it first. I loved the Rey-Kylo dynamic. They are the two best parts of the series. They're both fantastic. Kylo is a villain, as if not more interesting in many respects, than Darth Vader. I find him so, so interesting. I also liked the direction Luke took in this episode. I know this was probably the most controversial aspect for many diehard fans, but I did enjoy it, particularly as it expanded on our own understanding of the Force. I love the visual effects in this film. The destruction of the Star Destroyer is not just one of the best action set pieces I've seen all year, but one of the best visual pieces I've ever seen committed to film. And I liked Rose a lot. I thought she was a lovely character. I'd like to see more of her, very much so. Please, if you're listening, J.J. Abrams. What I did not like about the film, and there were several aspects. One was the follow-through from the last film. This is the second film in a trilogy. It should be the part of a trilogy. And as soon as Luke tossed the lightsaber off that ridge, I knew that we are looking at an entirely different film in tone and style. And I have a strong feeling that there has been a lack of planning in terms of mapping out the entire trilogy, which is quite strange to me. And I also saw this in respect to some of the major characters. Phasma and Snoke weren't two of the most interesting characters. They didn't necessarily deserve arcs akin to their predecessors in the original trilogy, but just killing them off in the way that happened, or at least the way it appeared to happen, was very perfunctory for me. I did like Snoke a lot. I thought it was really interesting, and I still have no idea who he is or where he came from. I didn't like how Domhnall Gleeson was characterized. He was one of the most terrifying aspects of the first film, was General Hux. And in this, he was basically thrown around rooms a lot and
comic
told
relief.
To... Yeah, he was
I was okay
relief.
With that. This movie had enough... Like, Snoke was a much bigger part of this movie. In the first film, I know, yes, he gets killed off randomly halfway through. If anyone's just tuning in now, we're spoiling the hell out of Star Wars The Last Jedi, so come back in 10 minutes if you want to hear some movie discussion that doesn't involve spoiling the movie.
Or just stay and listen to it and right don't watch Star Wars, because who
watch
cares?
Yeah, though I liked the movie, I wouldn't begrudge anyone who takes the suggestion that Virat made.
Thank you, Chris.
Anyway,
yes, Chris, what did you... I know we have a few different opinions on this. What did you think of The Last Jedi?
I thought it was a pretty good film. I thought it was the best action blockbuster of the year. I thought it showed a playfulness that's totally missing from the Marvel movies. I always like to take an opportunity on Film Fight Club to slam Marvel, and that trend will continue in 2018.
Yes, because we're consistent more than the Star Wars universe.
Probably. The Marvel movies, people always praise for being fun. But for me, they're lacking the fun of storytelling. You know, this is a movie that goes in wild directions and takes big swerves and twists. You know, even from the opening sequence, it's got this World War II movie homage bomber scene that has like three or four different twists, you know, just in the way that the action scene unfolds and plays out. Star Wars, for me, if you go back to Empire Strikes Back, which everyone seems to agree is the best, that's a movie just full of thrills and spills, just wild little mini twists from scene to scene to scene. And The Last Jedi brings back that kind of playfulness in tone and energy to just create a fun time, whereas I think Star Wars, prior to this, has gotten too self-serious. And I think it did a better approach to revitalizing Star Wars than The Force Awakens did. Because The Force Awakens, if anything, took Star Wars, like, treated it too much as a joke. This movie injected humor into the proceedings while still totally believing in its own world. You know, the Force Awakens was treating this like a franchise with how closely it stuck to A New Hope and was remaking elements of this. Whereas this was, you know, imagining a new story within this world and branching out from The Force Awakens a lot more in my mind. I agree with what you said about Rey and Kylo. I loved their dynamic. It was the most interesting thing about The Force Awakens and the only time in that movie where you could see Star Wars stretching out to become something more. And I think Rian Johnson continued it in a great way. I loved the kind of mix of sexual tension and comedy and malevolence in their scenes together.
And the shirtless Kylo Ren, which had to come up.
Which was hilarious. I liked how Luke Skywalker Mark Hamill in portraying him didn't play it too seriously, like a Gandalf kind of type character, and instead injected a little bit of like the old Star Wars campiness while still, you know, treating it to a degree seriously. I think we can talk later about people's problems with how they portrayed Luke in this movie. But I'll let Virat speak first. The last thing I'll say before I do that is always withholding the mic. The last thing I'll say is that Finn and Rose's storyline was really just filler designed to just keep this movie shuffling along. And I think even though that's how it introduced a lot of the like heroic action that, you know, because that wasn't really present in the other plot threads that were going on, I think that's its real purpose, to keep it, you know, Rey and Kylo are having a big human psychic drama and the Rebel Alliance are kind of squabbling about mutiny. Finn and Rose were there to inject like classic Star Wars action, but this movie was branching Star Wars out into something new and different, and that wasn't really necessary. Anyway, Virat?
Yeah, my biggest problems were definitely as to what this movie wanted to be, and I was confused throughout as to whether they wanted to be a human drama between Kylo and, you know, that kind of beautiful, very sort of interpersonal dynamic, which we haven't seen in Star Wars. It's always been about the big set pieces, and I was very sort of pleasantly surprised that this could be almost a two-person character study.
Almost like, I mean, Star Wars at its best has gone to that. Empire Strikes Back was going there with Luke and Yoda, and then Luke and Vader, and Revenge of the Sith was doing that with Anakin and Obi-Wan, right?
So they're following the rule of two from the Sith Order, effectively.
Yeah, basically. Yes. Star Wars is at its best when it's two people, like one representing light, one representing dark, and we get to see those ideas play out. Yeah. Even Rey and Kylo in Force Awakens is when it was at its most interesting, right?
But at the same time, I think that's what really sort of confused me, because in trying to do that, I wasn't sure it committed to that aspect to begin with. There, you know, every character from Rogue One, for example, was just shoehorned into this narrative, and I just didn't see the continuity there. And The Force Awakens was just, I just didn't see the point of that entire first movie. You know, this kind of made that whole first film redundant, if we're going to talk about that. So in terms of franchise continuity, I really had issues with that. And also, Adam Driver's portrayal of Kylo Ren.
Dude, you didn't like it? For me, that was one of my favorite performances in a movie all year.
Yeah,
like he was putting in something way beyond what Star Wars deserves.
that's true, but also it was too much like Patterson. So
that guy shows a lot of range, I think. Kylo Ren was...
But like, there was an amount of deep, brooding introspection that I was just like, oh, come on, man.
Patterson's like showing a goofy side, and Kylo Ren is just like goofy while trying to be...
I know, but it also felt goofy. So it just like, I was waiting for him to just break out into a Basho kind of poem, and like, you know, where I'm writing a haiku now about the mysteries of the universe or something. So
he probably does. I'm just trying to imagine now Kylo Ren sitting in Paterson, New Jersey. I've been through Paterson. It's an amazing image. But I got to say, I really enjoyed his performance in this film.
I loved it.
He was a petulant teenager, but also this terrifying a visage who you knew could take this empire and control worlds.
I'll just say, there's been a lot of criticism since The Force Awakens, and very much deserved in the case of The Force Awakens, about how this new Star Wars trilogy is hewing way too closely to the old. But Kylo Ren injected something really new into Star Wars, because like you were saying, you could be afraid of him while still kind of laughing at him, which is what I think real life evil often is, and it's much more relatable to us. Something like Darth Vader is just like a mega Hitler, colossal evil, as is the Emperor, who no one can imagine themselves being because they just represent evil. But when you look at Kylo Ren, you see the shades of darkness of like how a guy can just, you know, feel humiliated enough that he can just be brimming with anger. And you can laugh at how pathetic his motivations are, but still be afraid of what this guy's capable of.
I agree. In terms of actual sort of screenplay and storytelling, I was more convinced of Kylo's turn to the dark side than I was ever of Anakin's turn, which I thought was petulant. But here, you could really see the betrayal of Luke and how that affected him, and that continuous sort of, you know, nail in the coffin that drove him, you know, slowly. It wasn't just one moment. It was like over time. And that's what really... So that's nothing for the writing. But actually, I'm not sure about Adam Driver's portrayal. But there are other issues. For example, I just didn't... You know, after a point, I was like, am I watching an action movie which fantastical and that's fun, or am I watching something more grounded? And I was a bit torn apart by that kind of playfulness as to where my loyalty should lie in terms of the actual thematic tone of the film, whether I should just give in to the, am I watching something like The Greatest Showman, you know?
It undermines itself a little bit.
Yeah.
It does. Chris referred earlier to the Canto Bight sequence, about half an hour on this planet that probably belonged in The Phantom Menace. They could have excised
probably
this.
Belonged in the, on the cutting room floor.
If they could have excised this entire section from the film. I will say, though, the end scene on Canto Bight, which did require that,
yeah, that was fantastic.
Sequence, was so elegant and so well done. The major action sequences themselves, fleeing from the Dreadnought and from the First Order. Chris, when we first spoke about this, I know you referred to a Dunkirk narrative in a sense. Yep. I feel it was done well in parts. I feel, though, it was undermined by, I appreciate there's a strong element in this film of characters who you see as heroic and upstanding, doing things that are wrong or bad or misguided, yeah, and having serious consequences. Except the characters in this film, and I'm talking about Finn, Poe, and to an extent Rose, did things to such an egregious extent that I can't believe either the screenwriters or the superiors didn't just, you know, slap them the wrist, but didn't just lock them up. I would not let these guys anywhere near my brig, near my, you know, ship or near my, yeah, bridge if they had done any of the things they've done in that film.
Yeah, they made a lot of stupid mistakes, but I do appreciate characters just constantly messing up. However, it does, I guess I'm in having this conversation, I'm starting to understand why the fans don't like the movie so much, because it breaks the heroic fantasy of Star Wars to have characters that are so fallible and sometimes so idiotic, yet still wanting us to root for them. I prefer that kind of drama, but I think a lot of the fans don't, and they want Star Wars to stay very simple.
In that sense, Luke was interesting, and I will not delve into that debate right now, but just to, Luke for the entirety of the film, or most of the film, was definitely quite a jerk. And to then build up his legacy as what it did in, yep, the final turn was unbelievable for me. I just didn't buy it.
Can I say, with Luke Skywalker, though, people have this heroic image of Luke Skywalker. It has been built up over decades of fandom, but his character was not at all inconsistent with the Luke we knew back in the original trilogy, who was a bit annoying and who flirted, yep, with the dark side, particularly, yep, in Return of the Jedi. And this is the continuation of that story, the, yep, same story we saw with Rey.
But here he felt more like Harry Potter. No, like the reluctant, Kurt, you know, the one who just didn't want the mantle.
People have turned Luke into the avatar for their wish fulfillment. In, you know, people, I think, believe in Luke Skywalker, the action figure, not Luke Skywalker, the character from the original trilogy. And I thought this, I agree with Glenn, I think this is a conceivable version of Luke Skywalker from the original trilogy, who then goes through a massive depression after he fails after being believed to be the chosen one.
No, and that's fine. But then I just didn't buy the sort of, you know, mantlehood that is bestowed upon him and how he then departs into being the hero, the redemption story, essentially. Because then I bought him as this person who just rejected everything. And I'm like, okay, this is new. I actually like my heroes to actually fall. Mm. But then I didn't want him to rise because I was like, I don't care.
They didn't. The problem is the movie's too overstuffed. I think, yeah, it would be a much stronger film if it let a lot of, you know, fewer plot threads breathe. If we'd had more of a transformational arc for Luke towards him deciding to come back to the light, yeah, at the end, I think it would be a much stronger film.
Yeah, and my major issue with that sequence is that we knew, because of something that happened earlier, the absolute standout worst scene in the film for me, where Carrie Fisher used the Force to fly back to the ship.
I loved that. That was just, as I was watching it, I thought, is this terrible? Then I thought, no, this is great. It looks amazing. It's so surreal. Like, it's not portrayed in a typical way, the way she's kind of like reaching her hand out like a space wizard through all the broken glass and such. Like, it was so visually stunning and so ridiculous that I thought, all right, like, this is what I'm going to a movie to see, the movies to see something as big and dumb as Star Wars for, to like give me something crazy. But I get why people hate it, because it's like, isn't that cheating?
Yeah, I know it looks amazing, it did look amazing on the big screen, but that element of the Force has never been established so well as any of the others. And it also meant that suddenly we knew this film was not going to kill off major characters suddenly in a simplistic way. So when there is the final confrontation at the end, you know it's not going to be simply Luke blown up or Luke dispatched too easily, and that really undermined the suspense of what was the key and what could have been the most, what was one of the best sequences of the film, could have been one of the best sequences in the Star Wars saga.
Him dying, look, I liked the,
or did he?
Yeah. No, getting into the major spoilers now, guys, spoilers, if you're, yes, back on the air. Because we're coming up to 6:20 when we said we'd be wrapping this up. So if you're tuning in back now, spoilers continue for The Last Jedi. When Luke died, that just felt completely lazy to me. I was okay with the idea of him force projecting and pulling off a massive trick. I thought that was cool. Jedis are like magicians and illusionists and tricksters at heart, right? But, you know, it just to set us up like, oh, he's going forth to die on the planet. Oh, wait, it was all a prank. Luke's got the upper hand, but then he just dies anyway. It just felt kind of lazy.
I feel it does, though, establish the character he will be and the figure he will be in the next film. And certainly the figure Obi-Wan played in the original
trilogy. And I loved him inspiring the kids at the end. That was a gorgeous send-off scene. But the way that he died just felt kind of like having your cake and eating it, too. Like, exactly. They wanted us to have the satisfaction of Luke doesn't get killed by Kylo Ren. Ha-ha. But they also wanted Luke to die. You know, when I was first watching this scene, when Luke said, you know, if you strike me down, I'll still always be with you like your father. And then Kylo Ren runs towards him and pushes the lightsaber through him. Mm-hmm. And then he turns around like, haha, I'm still here. I thought that what had happened was that Kylo actually had killed Luke, but he was so strong with the Force that he's like, just like I said, I'm never going to leave you now. And he was like a ghost that was now always going to harass Kylo Ren. I was so excited for episode 9.
It's just this kid standing by his bedside table. Hey, Kylo, how's it going?
Yeah. I think that's too Rick and Morty for Star Wars.
Maybe it won't, but like, I want to see Star Wars do that kind of nuttiness.
It just might. Well, it brought back one of the nuttiest characters, Yoda. And I've got to say, I was so grateful for this, actually. Because we've seen Yoda in the prequels, and it was CGI Yoda, and it was terrible. And Jim Henson made a beautiful puppet back in 1980, and I was so glad to see him voiced by Frank Oz back on the big screen.
Voiced and acted. Because Frank Oz still does that on the set puppetry.
Yes, he does. And it was such an exquisite scene. And the scene where they burnt the Jedi tree. Again, this is one of the most controversial aspects, but it was wonderful.
That was gorgeous. And it was gorgeous in the way it tied into the idea of failure. Which, you know, I wish was more developed. But the film, I think we're talking about it on a high-level thematic level, right? Right now.
Yes.
To me, in a way, that's a victory in itself in a Star Wars movie released by Disney. Like, we could never talk about Force Awakens in this way.
Yeah, I agree. I think just to talk about
Thor Ragnarok.
Big, sort of supposedly commercial, big blockbuster movie, and we're talking about philosophical themes.
Even if it's a little bit clumsy, it tried to bring themes and ideas to a mass audience movie in a time when those are in a race for the bottom and just getting stupider and stupider. So I think Rian Johnson deserves some credit for what he's tried to do.
Yeah. Because the last time I think that happened was Logan with...
And for me, this is a better movie than Logan.
Ooh.
That would be a controversial take.
It's a different movie to Logan, and I don't feel I can compare it to The Force Awakens yet, because it's a different film to The Force Awakens. And I love that when it came out, because it fulfilled its objective. It told a familiar story, which it needed to do. It allowed this film to flourish, to be something different, which is why The Force Awakens has its place, and I feel this has its place too.
There's one more thing I think is worth bringing up before we move on from Star Wars. Earlier on, we were talking about the issue of franchise continuity. I feel like the biggest... this feels a lot different to The Force Awakens. But as you were saying just then, Glenn, The Force Awakens serves a purpose, right, in terms of franchise building. It was the, you know, we know you guys didn't like the prequels, so we'll show you that Star Wars can be just like it used to be when you loved it by remaking A New Hope and adding in elements of Empire and Return of the Jedi. It was kind of like a remix movie. But the problem is, I think that created a lot of the biggest flaws for this sequel trilogy going forward, which have been carried over and that Rian Johnson's inherited, because it just makes the way this universe works very unclear. Like, has the war been going on for 30 years and they've just changed their names? Because it brings us the exact same scenario that the original trilogy was about, only instead of the Rebel Alliance and the Empire, it's now the Resistance and the First Order. And it makes it feel like, is there just eternal war? If they'd set up a new scenario and then showed how the villains emerged there, then it would be okay. It's a new Star Wars story. But now there's kind of the sense that between the movies, if you're not reading up on all this expanded universe stuff, there's the sense that between the movies, like, nothing's changed and Star Wars stays in stasis so that Disney can keep telling the same story that sells.
Well, I'm hoping that, as we know, there's going to be another film every year for the rest of our lives. Effectively, these films could fill in these gaps, and I'm totally okay with that. I think I would like to know a little bit more about Snoke. Down the line, we may get that in the future film.
Okay. Where does Star Wars go forward from here? Because it seems like people have turned around and are rejecting the way that The Force Awakens was being so close to what the old Star Wars. And people are also rejecting The Last Jedi's attempts to really shake up the franchise and make it something that can go in new directions, like moving away from the centrality of the Skywalker family, you know, making it a less heroic fantasy with fallible characters, etc.
But that says something about fandom and its sort of good things or bad things about it, because that happened with Sherlock as well. You can pay lip service to fandom, and you can fall or die by the sword, or you can actually live by it. So it's terrible any way you go.
I think what I'm starting to worry about the franchise going forward, and a place where I think Disney have miscalculated, is that it's seeming like people don't really care about Star Wars, the saga, the continuing story, as much as they really love the moment in time when they first saw the Star Wars movies, and they want to keep that moment alive. And it's kind of like a nostalgia fetishized object now that can never really break forward and become something new.
Well, I actually remember, I'm going back to the very first episode of Film Fight Club here, we were talking about this issue, and I think Chris said, your exact words were, why can't Star Wars be a romance, or this or that in a different genre?
Yep.
And I'd be totally okay with that. I'd be totally okay with telling minor stories on smaller planets. I'd be totally okay with branching out this universe and talking about the people on Canto Bight and on these smaller planets. I liked Rogue One for that reason. I watched it for a second time over the summer. I realized how much I liked it even more because it told a completely different story. I'm okay with hearing different stories in the Star Wars universe. I read the Expanded books when I was a kid, and I'm pretty excited to see some of those stories writ large on the big screen. That was The Last Jedi. It will be in cinemas for a long time to come. We'll be back talking about the Golden Globes. This is me, the song winner from The Greatest Showman. Stay tuned. Your broken parts. I've learned to be ashamed of all my scars. Run away, they say, no one will love you as you are. But I won't let them break me down to dust. I know that there's a place for us, for we are glorious. When the sharpest words wanna cut me down, I'm gonna send a flood, gonna drown them out. I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me. Look out, cause here I come. And I'm marching on to the beat I drum. I'm not scared to be seen. I make no apologies. This is me. This is me from The Greatest Showman. I saw it. It's a wonderful film. We will be reviewing it. This is Glenn.
This is Chris.
And this is Virat. Oh, that's Virat.
That's
and
not
altogether.
Me.
This Bill. Is Free. Me.
We could do harmonies too. Yeah, you hear that, Hugh Jackman? So yeah, that was great.
That harmony, Corrine.
Wow, that really.
I thought up that one over spring break.
Breakers, yeah. Heartbreakers.
Speaking of spring breakers, we are talking about the Golden Globes, including Golden Globe Best Actor winner James Franco for The Disaster Artist. Wow. It is it's 2018 and James Franco brought Tommy Wiseau up on stage. What world do we live in?
It's 2018 and James Franco brought a Time's Up pin on stage and created a social media backlash. So just as promised, one of your beloved celebrities has been tarnished since we returned over the break from his Film Fight Club.
He took away the mic from Tommy Wiseau after bringing him up on stage. What is the point of that?
That was a weird kind of ego moment, wasn't it?
Yeah,
like, we must give Frank, you know, props to Tommy Wiseau, but haha, remember you're a joke.
To be fair, he brought his brother up too, and Dave didn't say anything, so...
But who cares about Dave? Yeah,
he definitely should have given Tommy Wiseau the mic. Like, this is Tommy Wiseau's moment.
Well, we can only hope that James Franco would win the Oscar, and he can bring Tommy Wiseau, because he has promised to bring Tommy Wiseau to the Oscar if The Disaster Artist gets nominated.
Look, let's
isn't that the insulting thing? Like, I felt that was a very insulting moment. Like, oh, I'm going to bring you, but only because I basically... feed it off your sort of notoriety.
Let's
just
be honest.
And then I won.
Tommy Wiseau is a more important and more significant film artist than James Franco. Let's be clear.
Yeah,
about
James
this.
Franco will not have won.
James Franco is one of the prolific artists in Hollywood. He makes like 12 films a year.
Yeah, but they're not good.
A lot of them are.
The Disaster Artist is the first good one in like years. He makes adaptations of Hemingway novels that no one wants to see and that aren't good.
But like, anyway. There would be no Disaster Artist. There would be no Golden Globe for Best Actor for James Franco without Tommy Wiseau. There needs to be the worst film of all time for James Franco to win this. I mean, we're forgetting that
there needs to be a worst
fact.
James Franco award for James Franco to take out every year. And no, Tommy Wiseau hands it to him, and Tommy Wiseau takes the mic off him when he presents it and gives a speech.
So no, I think Seth Rogen will win that.
Right.
He's made so many excellent films go on. But I do think we'll be seeing much, much more of him at the PGA and at the DGA and all these
James
other
Franco,
award ceremonies.
If he doesn't get tanked by the... we'll see.
We'll see.
Time's up.
Speaking of which, the Golden Globes. So the ceremony happened this week. It is a precursor to the Oscars each year. And it hands out awards for Best Picture in Drama and Comedy. And this year, the Best Motion Picture Drama went to Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. This opened on January 1st in cinemas. We saw, so we talked about it briefly, and then going on to
the rest of the Golden Globe stuff.
It had a number of other nominations, I just want to note. This beat out Dunkirk, The Post, The Shape of Water, and Call It By Your Name, all of which are absolutely superb films. So it was quite a feat. But yeah, Three Billboards. What did we think of the latest by Martin McDonagh?
Virat, maybe you should speak about this one first before I derail the conversation.
Yeah, because Chris absolutely hated this one. I really liked it. I liked it in the sense that it was very unlike Martin McDonagh. It was definitely one of his more understated efforts, if there could be anything understated about Martin McDonagh. But also, it was definitely very Irish. And I felt that was interesting because this was set in America, and yet it was definitely a very Irish film. So I was like, what are you doing? What is happening? But Woody Harrelson was interesting in that he played it quite straight-faced. Frances McDormand, great performance, but outside of this universe, is it actually feasible? I'm not sure.
Nothing in this movie is feasible outside of this highly contrived universe.
You have to buy the sort of fallacy of this universe to actually like this movie. And I bought it, and I loved it. But I can see why if people just don't buy that, then it's very difficult to get into the movie because everything is highly socially constructed in the cinematic universe.
Yeah, look, this movie won the award for Best Screenplay.
And Best Actress and Best Supporting Actor for Sam Rockwell.
Yeah, but it's particularly with the screenplay win that I have problems because for me, it's the kind of movie where like characters talk a lot, so people will say, oh, it's so well written, but it, for me, it's bad on a basic screenplay level in that it relies on constant contrivances. You know, you can forgive like one coincidence because life's like that, but when a movie just has like four or five coincidences and every turning point hinges on a coincidence, and also the characters are just stupid to allow events to go forward, they do stupid things. Sam Rockwell does stupid things, Frances McDormand does stupid things, Woody Harrelson is a freaking idiot because he despite being this empathetic, warm, beautiful man, allows Sam Rockwell to be under his employee when this is a guy who the movie constantly makes reference to how he tortures a black guy in his custody. Like, this universe is inconsistent.
But this is a Martin McDonagh film, and he doesn't glamorize his characters. He's not trying to glamorize his characters. And I feel purely as a character study, there are three very intriguing characters here. This is the Sam Rockwell, Frances McDormand, Woody Harrelson characters. The others are not particularly well developed. Lucas Hedges is in this film from Manchester by the Sea. I don't know what he was doing there. He's such a superb actor, but he had such a small role, as did Samara Weaving and Abby Cornish.
Yeah.
I liked elements of this film. I had other major issues, but Chris, I think you had really strong.
Really strong issues. Yeah, the last, I'll try and keep it brief since we have so much to cover on the show tonight, but the last thing I wanted to say until something else flares up.
Felix.
Is that the problem was, I think in this movie, it was almost like Martin McDonagh's sellout movie for me. Like, he was trying to have it both ways in how much he went into sentimentalizing. There's a few terrible scenes. It's kind of like, you know, Chris Nolan making Interstellar when he's been criticized for not being able to do emotion. Suddenly, you know, the guy who doesn't glamorize his characters, as you say, is suddenly trying to create heart-wrenching scenes that make you feel for them, and that's clearly way outside of his comfort zone. So, you know, I couldn't balance out in my mind some of the things Frances McDormand does and then the ways that it tries to get us on side with her. Same for Sam Rockwell's character, or the way that it mocks a character then tries to make us feel for them the next moment. It just felt wildly insincere while striving for sincerity. I couldn't stand a lot of the underlying essence of what McDonagh was doing here.
I'll just rebut one point when you brought up about how Woody Harrelson's character could have Sam Rockwell's character under his employee when he was obviously so racist. I think McDonagh was trying to make that point about the current sort of racial tensions and how the police are complicit in allowing a lot of people in their employee, and they kind of willfully overlook that fact, and that's been going on in American racial tensions. At this point, whether that was successful or that was too on the nose, I'm not quite sure, but I can see the point he was trying to make.
I think that was too on the nose because Sam, you know, if you're going to make that kind of commentary on the racial situation with police in America, then it should go for like burn it all down. Everyone in this system is irredeemable, kind of like an angry movie, you know, cut out, because as it is, it doesn't make sense to have this, you know, man of such integrity presiding over this totally racist force.
Except that Woody Harrelson, we only meet his character at a particular stage in the character's development. I don't want to ruin an aspect.
Maybe
of the
he
film.
Is and getting that, better as a man, but I'm just not sure.
Well, that,
we weren't given enough to know. You know, the world building isn't very strong in this film.
We weren't. As much as I did enjoy elements of it, the last 40 minutes was quite unstructured, and I feel we've only got a fraction of a movie and a fraction of a story. I feel it wanted to build to a big set piece, and it did, but I wanted to know what happened afterwards. We just sadly did not.
Yeah, this is a movie about, like, taking action, and it kind of trails off into place of, should we take action? I don't know. Whereas the interesting thing is about the crazy actions that this lady takes.
But also, like, that's the point of Irishness in a sense. It's so sarcastic and so self-referential that you forget if there's a point to anything. And I think that's just a British-Irish sensibility coming through of Martin McDonagh, where he's like a piss take about everything. And then you forget whether there's something, any point to all of it, you know? Whether there's something, any stakes at all.
So that was the best drama of the year, three billboards.
It was the best comedy of the year, however. I'd like to remind everyone that there were a number of other excellent films nominated in this category. Disaster Artist, The Greatest Showman, the song from which we just played, I, Tonya, which I'm very excited to see in a week, and Get Out, which definitely belonged to this category. But the one that did win was Lady Bird, also won. Saoirse Ronan won Best Performance by an Actress in a Musical Comedy Motion Picture.
So
for
keen
this.
To see that.
Saoirse Ronan.
Saoirse?
Saoirse.
Excuse me for mispronouncing. All right. So that is, and that is, we yet to see this. We can't.
Sorry, Martin McDonagh.
We're
offending the Irish.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's a piss take, so he'll enjoy it.
Well, moving on to other British subjects, Gary Oldman won Best Actor for The Darkest Hour, as can be expected. He was the only good aspect of an absolutely, in every other respect, terrible film.
You know, I hated that. That was the worst thing to have happened in 2017.
You know, I think that if you star in a movie that's just so obviously baiting for Oscars, like a hagiography of Winston Churchill, you should be disqualified from award consideration.
But also, we just don't need to glorify Churchill. He was a terrible, terrible historical figure. Can we stop making Churchill hagiographies,
yes,
please?
We did talk about this last year.
Yeah, thank you.
He is a contentious figure. It was not covered that well in the film. It was quite disappointing in that respect. A much better film was The Shape of Water, of which Guillermo del Toro
seeing it over
won
the weekend.
Best Director. I saw this last night. We were to talk about the film properly next week. I think I'd like to address it purely in terms of direction. It is an affectionate, exquisite fairy tale. He puts together beautiful scenes, not just in the land that we know, but below water. And I've got to say, it is difficult. It is very difficult. And it's very hard to do. I can't remember the last time it's been done in a mainstream film of this caliber, to have two characters who don't communicate in a traditional way through dialogue as we would see in every other film that's been nominated, and to create empathy and emotion between these characters and with the audience and have them on screen for most of the action is remarkable, and he did an outstanding job of that.
Looking forward.
It's a beautifully shot film. I mean, I was amazed just by the quality of some.
We're
going to
do a roundtable on it next week.
Yes.
So save some of the thoughts.
But I had issues with some of the social commentary, which we will go in depth next week and
okay,
talk
cool.
about it.
Best Motion Picture Animated was Coco.
Man, I've heard such good things about this.
This is...
But I wanted to catch it before I did my top 10 because I'm hearing it's that good, but I couldn't see it before today. Sorry, guys.
This is a return to form for Pixar. It is an absolutely beautiful film. There are a couple of twists. You may or may not see them coming, but regardless, it will hit you. It is emotional. It is raw. The music is absolutely glorious, and the... There are many great one thing I'll say about this film, I think we will review it probably in a coming week. There are many great after-credit sequences, whether it be Marvel or what else. This has the best after-credit sequence I've seen in any film. You see this film, stay after the credits. It is so elegant and masterful, and of all the emotional elements of this film, it packed the biggest punch. Go see this. It is absolutely marvelous.
Right.
Move over, Call Me By Your Name. And
no,
the after-credit
no.
scenes of that one.
No.
That's during credits. That doesn't count. Oh, can I just
well
say
played.
Briefly on why the Golden Globes have no credibility, according to Chris Evans of 2SER's Film Fight Club. They also do TV awards, and of course, Twin Peaks was snubbed in the Best Limited Series or Drama, but Kyle MacLachlan was nominated for what was probably one of the best filmed performances of the year in any medium, Best Actor in a Limited Series or Drama Series, and lost to Ewan McGregor for Fargo, who was good, but clearly nowhere near as good. So...
Because
he played... The big thing was he played twins, but Kyle MacLachlan played four or five characters in Twin Peaks.
The thing is, like, nobody understands Twin Peaks.
That's right. Yeah, I think Golden Globes people have pretty simplistic, shallow taste. You know, they go for very simple kind of.
They nominated Twin Peaks because they're like, oh my God, David Lynch, without understanding.
But they didn't nominate the show. They nominated Kyle MacLachlan because it's like, we don't like the show, but we'll give credit where credit's due. But, you know, they didn't come through, and that was clearly amazing. Anyway, I'll stop talking about Twin Peaks.
But is Twin Peaks TV, or is it like.
Yeah, is it TV or is it movie, as film Twitter has been debating?
It would not be Fight Club without David Lynch. So here you go.
Look, I won't include it in my top 10 because, let's be fair, it's not a movie. But for a lot of critics, it is. It appeared at number 2 in BFI's list of the best from polling the largest critics poll worldwide.
Yeah.
It was the second best film of 2017, according to film critics.
Idiot.
Yeah, they're stupid because it's a TV show, clearly. But, you know, to reach number 2 while not even actually being a movie, I think is a huge accomplishment. Which
you heard it here first, guys.
How many people are talking about this show as a movie and in the film critic circle. So,
In pure defense of the Golden Globes, I do have to say for best drama, they did Handmaid's Tale, did beat out Game of Thrones and a number of others. And Nicole Kidman has won for a number of series. And it's... you think it was a given?
I mean, if they gave it to Game of Thrones again, I would have given up my throne of whatever throne I had, I didn't have any.
Well, season 7, we have covered, it was not particularly great in many respects. I'm hoping season 8 in 2019
I don't care how many incest scenes they have, it's not going to save the show.
For the Golden Globes?
It is it for the Golden Globes. We'll be back in a moment talking about our best of 2017. But for the moment, we will lead you out with the best original score winner, which is a beautiful song from, again, that lovely, lovely film, The Shape of Water.
J'avoue, je n'ai bavé pas vous, mon amour. Avant d'avoir eu vent de vous. Mon amour, ne vous déplaise en dansant la javanaise. Nous aimions le temps d'une chanson. Votre avis, qu'avons-nous vu de l'amour, de vous à moi, vous m'avez.
And that was The Shape of Water. That is in cinemas next Thursday. Please, please do see it. We had to wait till 2018 to talk about our best of 2017. So we're going to go into that now. We put together our top 10 lists. It's been a big year of films. We've seen a lot of films, a lot of festivals. We each had to pick a few favorites. It was very difficult. But one I had to pick, I saw it at the Adelaide Film Festival. It is coming out on later this month, I think January 25th, I believe, which is Warwick Thornton's Sweet Country. It is absolutely one of the best films of the year, starring Halton Morris, Sam Neill, Brian Brown, Matt Day. Absolutely superb.
Are we talking about Sweet Country now? I thought we were waiting until it comes out.
We will wait to talk about it properly, but to say this is a thriller, it is a drama, it is incredible social commentary with some of the best performances I've seen from Australian actors, not just all year, but all decade.
Even though I saw it late last year, because it's coming out so soon and it's going to get a wide release and mostly be spoken about in terms of 2018 films, I've elected not to include it in my 2017 top 10, but it would be there. So that's my high praise for Sweet Country. Look forward to it.
And Chris, do you have a nomination for Best of 2017?
Look, I wrote a top 10, which I could rattle off to you, and then we could pick holes in it. We all have our top 10s, right? Is it worth reading them all, or should we just? We should. I thought we could give out the palm fist, Film Fight Club's palm fist, after we've settled on what's the best according to our consensus.
That's true. Yeah, let's do that. Let's rattle off. Let's have our moment.
All right, Vrat, do you want to go first?
All right, my top 10. In alphabetical order, because that's the only order I could arrange these in, because I just don't know how much I like these. 24 Frames by Abbas Kiarostami, final feature film before his death, screened at Cannes 2017, and it was fantastic. It was basically, just 24 4.5 segments, just images, and it's beautiful. I can't, just watch it. Just honestly, I have no words for this. Then another Iranian filmmaker, A Man of Integrity by Mohammad Rasloff, which was won the jury prize at Cannes.
Man, I really wanted to see that film, but I just couldn't catch the two screenings.
If you've seen really any Oscar for Hardy film, this has shades of a lot of that.
What did we think of The Salesman, by the way?
I liked it, but not
it was
as
less
much. It's less fulfilling.
Anyway,
but if you like that kind of social critique of Iran, which does amazing social commentary in a land which is full of censorship, I just still don't see how they do it, but they're sort of amazing about it. Anyway, it's a beautiful film. Next one is Hotel Salvation, which screened at the Sydney Film Festival. See it, because its premise is the most interesting thing. It's an old patriarch who checks into a hotel in Varanasi, basically because he wants to die. And there is an Indonesian spaghetti western called Marlena the Murderer in four acts, which is interesting. There is Newton, which we've already talked about. There is a Story of an Egghead, which was a surprise comedy directed by debutant Rajvi Shetty, which is now on Netflix, which you can catch. There's Hang Sung Soo films. There are four that premiered last year.
I missed every single one of his releases of 2017.
The one I picked is On the Beach at Night Alone, which is obviously the part autobiographical thing, affair with the actress Kim Min Hee, and she won the Best Actress Silver Bear at the Berlinale, so it's a beautiful film to catch. There is also Over the Fence, which I saw at the Japanese Film Festival by Nobuhiro Yoshimita. Yamashita. There we go.
Great.
That was good. And there's Take Off by Mahesh Narayan, based on a real-life story of some nurses trapped in Iraq and fighting ISIS. And there is Song to Song.
Ooh, Terrence Malick makes his appearance.
Wow.
Wrap it up.
All right. Oh dear. Yeah, we've talked about this at great length, and yeah, not one of my
interesting to pick Song to Song. I mean, I'm the Malick fanboy in the house, and that one's not one of my favorites, but it has its qualities.
And Malick gets his first mention for 2018.
Many more to come.
He has a film coming out this year, so
we'll talk about
him again.
we can talk about it.
We promise we'll review it. My top 10, I've already mentioned Sweet Country. We've talked about The Disaster Artist tonight. When I do a top 10 or a listicle, I try to pick ones that are a little different, that represent a range of genres, because there are just so many fantastic films out there. And I love thrillers and I love romance, but there is quite no match for comedy. And there were some wonderful comedies this year, including The Disaster Artist. Logan was also mentioned this week. This was one of my top 10, one of the best comic book films of my lifetime, and certainly the best X-Men film since 2002 or 2003, where they had X2 come out. Hugh Jackman doing something very different. Get Out did not win the Golden Globe. It was one of my all-time favorites. I rewatched this with my roommates about a week ago, and they hadn't seen it, and we were having so much fun. It is an absolutely superb satire with so many layers, and each time you watch it, you learn and notice new things. Call You By Your Name got a mention this week. That is absolutely superb. It is about identity, it is about romance, it is about adolescence.
Call Me By Your Name is sticking true to my predicted trajectory for it, which is the annual movie that gets nominated but it's way too good to win any awards. It's like, it's too good for these competitions, but it's going to be remembered in the long haul.
It's not.
It is.
I have to agree with Chris. I do also agree that it will not necessarily do particularly well at the Oscars. We'll be talking about this more in coming weeks. It is a very, very large slate this year. My money at the moment is on All the Money in the World, but that could change any day and in any week.
I'm saying Lady Bird.
I have not seen Lady Bird yet, so I will withhold judgment until I have seen what is, by all accounts, an excellent film. Wonder Woman is my favorite superhero film of the year. Gal Gadot was absolutely excellent. We see very few films about World War One, and I thoroughly enjoyed watching this. I enjoy action films, I enjoy clever action films, and this was clever in many respects, and I appreciated everything it did, not just for the genre, but for creating a good DC comic book film. And now this is a bit of a surprise one, maybe, John Wick 2.
Ooh, yeah, that's an interesting pick.
I really enjoyed the first John Wick, and this was larger, this was bigger.
It was better.
It was better, and it was operatic. And the sequence where all the assassins are running around New York successfully trying to kill him is one of the funniest and best action sequences I've seen all year.
There was a lot of great variety in action scene direction. John Wick was good, but I felt got a bit too repetitive. But John Wick 2 finds ways to keep it interesting, you know, throw in twists and throw in elements of comedy to stop it from becoming a one-note kill fest.
Yeah, the final action sequence in that glass sort of
terrific. It's an action movie
fantastic.
Cliche almost, going back to Bruce Lee, but this was executed in such a great way. Like it was more like we're throwing our hat in with that tradition, and we're going to do it well.
Still don't know what Ruby Rose was doing in this movie, but apart from that, everything was pretty good.
Hopefully she'll be in the next one too. I also saw the reunion of Lawrence Fishburne and Keanu Reeves after a very long hiatus on screen together, and that was quite exciting for all the Matrix fans out there, myself included. Next film was an Australian film, the first Australian film on the list. Actually, it was Australian-American co-production, Better Watch Out. I like this for a number of reasons, not only because it was filmed down the road from my childhood home, which made it that extra bit scary, but it dealt with one of the major frustrations of modern film is that people, writers aren't necessarily aware of how to deal with communication and cellular technology and advances in this. There's an amazing YouTube pastiche of all the times in modern films where people have said, there's no reception, I can't get reception. They said a very clever way of handling it and also reunited the cast of The Visit, another absolutely superb film. Another Australian film we'd give a shout out to, we've talked about it on during the Sydney Film Festival, That's Not Me, which got a cinematic release. I'm just so impressed that this film was made by Alice Voucher and Greg Ernstein for $60,000-odd, and for a film of that quality on that budget, literally a thousandth of what The Room was made for, it is just, it's bloody impressive, and well done to them.
It's my favorite Aussie film of the year, well, of last year.
Wait, did you see Sweet Country?
I did, and I still didn't like it as much as I like this.
Right, interesting. So better watch out. I've got to check it out.
That's not me. That's not me.
Oh, that's not me. Sorry.
It,
right.
Sorry. And I did actually. I said that Better Watch Out was the first Aussie film. It was not. I referred to Sweet Country earlier, so it was the second Aussie film I referred to.
Right.
Another one, Brigsby Bear, my favorite Mark Hamill film of the year. This, like Disaster Artist, but I feel in a much better way, spoke to just cinema and a love of cinema and our obsession, an obsession for many people in a way, and how that can be positive, how it can be negative. It did it in an extreme satirical way, but I felt it was a very mature film and one of the best of the Saturday Night Live crowd I've ever seen. And the last one, this is one Chris and I both loved. We saw it together right before this show started, and we feel it is one of them. Well, I certainly feel it's one of those underrated films of the year, and that was Martin Scorsese's Silence. Many saw Hacksaw Ridge. This is a similarly thematic film, also starring Andrew Garfield. If you have not seen this, it's 2 hours 40 minutes, but it is well worth the time. One of Liam Neeson's best performances. It is also of an era and a place and a time which is not very well dealt with in Western cinema. That was Japan in the 17th century. Adam Driver, again, my favorite Adam Driver film of the year, and he was absolutely brilliant as the priest who went with Garfield to the country. I strongly recommend to seek it out on video, DVD, or anywhere.
Here's my top 10. If I can convince you guys now, I'll put forward my best film of the year as Silence. That's the one I would push for. For me, this film showed Scorsese mastering classical filmmaking form. It's such a traditional movie. You know, I'm a guy who usually flips out over the experimental David Lynch or Terrence Malick such stuff, but this is like classical filmmaking with, you know, in line with some of what Scorsese was doing in the 70s, but also feeling like an homage in some ways to Kurosawa's 60s work in the kind of stately, wide kind of shots showing the masses of Japanese armies. And in the way it's so attuned to nature and the depth of emotion that it was going to, this was reaching kind of like Dostoevsky novel type intention of probing into faith and morality and human choices and human suffering. So to me, Silence was an underseen film that should have the push. Call Me By Your Name, I saw again recently and was just as moved as the first time I saw it. I have to talk about The Florida Project briefly. I was stunned by that movie. I loved Willem Dafoe's performance, but I also loved the mother and daughter in this film. I thought it was aesthetically beautiful, but you know, and funny, but also very empathetic. 24 Frames, I'm agreeing with Virat. 24 Frames for me was one of the highlights of the year. That film was just so minimal, but found so much beauty in small gestures. Kiarostami was a master till the very end. I really liked, one that I know you guys weren't so into, Korosmaki's The Other Side of Hope, which, you know, was a droll kind of comedy, you know, that sometimes gets very silly, but balanced that in a way that not everyone will be on board with, but for me worked very well with a serious drama about the refugee crisis in Europe. I loved also 20th Century Women, which I know you guys weren't so big on, but for me, that movie transcended the kind of easy indie kind of setup to have some really interesting things to say about how we relate to art and how we relate to our families and friends. I loved The Lost City of Zed, James Gray making a great traditional adventure story and infusing it with a lot of depth. I loved the audaciousness and the ridiculousness of Mother. So I'm giving that one a place on my list. I liked it for doing something, you know, doing something crazy and being unafraid to. You know, next up, probably Good Time. And I think Good Time deserves credit. That's the movie that finally sold me on Robert Pattinson
And that's a movie with just thrills and spills, right?
It was a good time.
It's a great character study of an idiot dressed up as a thriller and drenched in neon colors. You know, Over the Fence, I'd give some credit to at the Japanese film. I'm going over 10 now, but just quickly, I loved Over the Fence. I loved Before We Vanish by Kiyoshi Kurosawa. I loved Logan Lucky. You know, I it's too early to say if it's in the list because I saw it a couple of days ago, but I saw Paddington 2 and it charmed my pants off.
Whoa!
Yeah, I think in coming weeks we will be reviewing properly The Florida Project and Paddington 2. The Florida Project is superb. I prefer it to Sean Baker's earlier film Tangerine.
But it improved on all the problems that I had with Tangerine, in my opinion. It addressed them. It felt like a solid looking at, okay, how can I improve my filmmaking and stepping forward?
I have to agree. And we had Debbie on last year, Debbie Zhao, and she spoke about Paddington 2 and just what an excellent film it was. I hadn't seen it at the time. I haven't seen it since. And I think this particular series just goes above and beyond in terms of something that is engaging for children and adults, but uniquely on the same level.
Just briefly, what was great about Paddington 2, kids' movies are almost always, the American ones at least, designed around, there's the moral, and the characters always recite the moral, and it's thrust onto you. This movie has a moral in the way that a movie for adults would have, which is just, it emerges through what happens in the story. It trusts kids' intelligence to be able to figure out what this movie's about, rather than saying, and the moral of the story is, blah, 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 blah. Anyway.
I'm particularly impressed you had Lost City of Z in there.
Right, thanks.
That was, I had forgotten about that film. I liked it at the time. I liked traditional old school adventure. It was a story that is true and that I was not familiar with. And I'm hoping we're going to see more from Charlie Hunnam because he made two films last year. One of them was released a few weeks before. The King Arthur film was terrible, but this was superb. So hoping
Londinium.
Excellent drop. Yes, Londinium.
So we've just got what was the other movie? Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, we've
King
got 4 minutes left.
We've got 4 minutes, yeah.
King Arthur was bad.
So there's a few common ones in there. Call You By Your Name certainly had a couple of...
I feel like Virat's hatred is enough to stop that from being the film Fight Club.
No, they just go and watch it and make up your own mind. Don't let my obviously correct take influence your, whatever.
Yes, please do Call Me By Your Name. It is in cinemas now. Maybe Get Out is the film of the year? I don't know.
Oh, look, Get Out I thought was okay, but I find it vastly overrated.
I liked Colossal way more than Get Out.
I think I probably would prefer Colossal. No, maybe they're pretty similar in quality, but maybe Colossal made me think more.
Yeah.
Get Out was a little bit obvious.
Maybe that's a colossal mistake on my part, but who knows?
They were both very good. They'd be in my extended top 20, top 25 kind of range.
Well, it seems Sweet Country is a possibility, but that might be the film of 2018 rather than 2017.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, I saw Warwick Thornton doing a publicity shoot for it down the road the other day. I was like, oh my God, I wanted to go up.
He did great. Sweet Country is great, but I'm holding that out for now. Is it possible we can come to a consensus here?
I don't know. There's so many. There was excellent films.
What did you think of Silence?
I didn't like it. I think 24 frames might just...
24 frames is amazing.
Yeah. I'm really sold on that.
I think Glenn didn't see it. So
I haven't. Well, it wouldn't be Film Fight Club without a lack of consensus on a film of the year.
Yeah, that's true. I wonder if it's possible. What about Good Time? We all liked that.
Okay, yeah. I really like Good Time. Okay. Yeah, we're going to agree on
that. Do you like Florida Project?
Not as much.
Okay.
But Good Time, yes. I'm definitely on board with Good Time.
I could nominate Florida Project. I mean, this was one of Willem Dafoe's career performances and otherwise an entirely understated film. They filmed this just down there at Disney World. You could have done it, and it probably did it on a shoestring budget.
Yeah, I could easily give it to Florida Project.
Yeah, and not Florida feel... Project, or even Get Out. Okay, I'm on board. Okay, why not?
Get Out. Wow, it's Get Out. We spent a lot of time talking on that about pun. Get Out.
I just thought that movie was... Like, it was okay. Like, it was good, but I didn't like how it devolved into, kill everyone to get out at the end. That felt too easy for what they'd set up. Like, it should have had a smarter conclusion.
If Jordan Peele went with the original ending of Get Out, which is included in the extended DVD edition, then that would have been more interesting.
I'm excited to hear this now. So, we'll be back.
You can watch it.
We'll be back, maybe, with a consensus movie.
In coming weeks, because we have many more films to review. We'll be talking about The Shape of Water next week and a number of others. The Post, we'll also be speaking about. A film that will be one of the many vying for the Academy Awards, which have the nominations out on January 23rd, 24th.
Maybe if we can't come to a consensus, we should just name a top film of the year each. We've rattled them off, but we've thought about it. What's the best?
That's a tough call. I don't know. I would have... There's a few that I would put out.
Is there anything particularly close to your heart?
Get Out, Silence, and Sweet Country would be among my favorites.
Yeah, I'd say Silence, and if I break the rule I put earlier, Sweet Country. And then Call Me By Your Name. And then Florida Project.
Story of an Egghead, Man of Integrity, and 24 Frames.
24 Frames. Man, I want to mention that one too. Ah! So many good films. Go.
Consensus.
I like me and Virat's 20. We'll give it to 24 Frames, and Glenn can cry in the corner.
So that was the last time we hear from Glenn. This has been Film Fight Club for this week. We'll be back at 6 o'clock next Wednesday night talking about The Post, Sweet Country, a number of others, and talking more about awards season, which is kind
Shape of Water, right?
And the Shape of Water. Oh, wow.
Next week.
Please stay tuned for Stages. They will be having some excellent coverage of the City Festival, which is in full swing now. And please, yes, if you like the show, look at us up on the 2SER page, and we'll be back next Wednesday.
I apologize for the crying in the corner. You know we love you, Glenn.
Have a wonderful night.